Each day, all over the world, thousands of healthcare learners experience the power of simulation. This is the BS Podcast.
Wait, what?
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 Beyond Simulation, exploring the stories of the people behind these masterfully implemented simulations.
Each episode discovers the real stories of how these connoisseurs got into simulation and why they stayed. This is the Behind the Music Podcast of the world of simulation.
Hello, everyone. My name is Christine Park, and I'm the director of the Simulation and Integrative Learning Institute at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. And one thing about me that is not simulation is that one of my favorite hobbies is learning languages. And recently, I've been thinking about what will my next language be that I would like to learn. And I think if I could think about what's the furthest from anything that I currently know, it would be Arabic.
Arabic. That's awesome. Wow. So hi, everybody. My name is Bob Kaiser. I am the associate director here at SAIL. And one thing about me that is not simulation related, and I'm going to get a little personal here, I'm going to share a childhood memory. So when I was a kid, my father and I built a theater in my backyard out of 2x4s and some crates for the stage, and it was so much fun. I loved it. I did plays for my dog. The thing I did not think about is that people on the side streets could see inside my backyard. So when I went back to school the following fall, all my friends knew what I did in my backyard, but it was still a lot of fun. So and I would do it again, but I just wish I had thought about that part. So yeah.
My question is there any video documentation of this so that we could play it when we make a documentary about your life?
There is not. And how grateful am I that like YouTube and TikToks and all that were not around when I was a kid? I'm just grateful. So
yeah, me too. I'm with you on that one.
Oh.
All right. So are you ready to talk some BS?
Bring it on, Christine. Let's do it.
We are recording this episode here in the month of April, which made me remember, I have a question for you. Do you know where the origin of April Fool's Day came from? Because we got pretty seriously tricked by one of our staff on April Fool's Day.
Again, she gets me every year. I think it is from Greek origins. I think there used to be some kind of festival or something at the end of March, and it was it ended with kind of this comedic type of event. Am I right?
Well, apparently April Fool's Day might be the world's longest running joke because nobody exactly knows how it began. Another theory is that April Fool's Day goes back to when France switched from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar, and so it switched when the new year was.
Oh, okay.
Had you heard that?
I had not heard that, no. Yeah, but I'm pretty gullible, as we have all found out in the office.
So here's what we do know. In 1561, there is the first clear-cut reference to April Fool's Day, appearing in a Flemish poem written by Edouard de Denne. In the poem, a nobleman sends his servant out on a series of wild errands, and the servant finally realizes that these are fool's errands, because the date is April 1st. Hence the origin of that phrase.
Love it.
Wow, that's so cool.
Who knew?
All right, little historical tidbit for today. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome our guest to the podcast today. Today we have with us Dr. Jennifer Arnold. She is the program director at Boston Children's Hospital Simulator Program, also known as SimPeds, and an attending neonatologist in the maternal fetal care program. Welcome, Jen.
Hey, thank you so much. It's great to be here with both of you. Oh my goodness, this is going to be a lot of fun.
All right, so diving right in, right off the bat, tell us, what are three things that you are professionally known for?
Okay, Well, I guess one is healthcare simulation. I've been involved in simulation, oh gosh, since I was a neonatal perinatal fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And that's where I got the bug at the Weiser Center. And let's see. The second thing, most folks know that I'm a neonatologist. So that's my clinical hat. The third thing I'm known for is probably related to patient and family-centered care sim specifically. So that's something I'm very passionate about, developing and growing that sort of subfield of our simulation field of bringing simulation to patients and families.
That's great. So Jennifer, this show is beyond simulation. So we want to know a little bit more beyond your professional credits. So before the show, I spun a random number generator and I got the number 3. So could you tell us 3 things that are not on your resume or CV, things that are not professional?
Ooh, okay. 3 things. All right. Well, number 1, do I have to be good at them though? No, I don't, right?
No.
It's not at all.
Not at all.
Perfect.
Or not perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. 3 things about me not on a CV. I enjoy painting. I haven't done it in a while, but it's something that I've enjoyed since I was a kid. Acrylics and oils are my paint of choice. And I'm absolutely horrible at it, but I like it. Let's see. Second thing that people may not know is that I also really like interior design and decorating. I pretty much spend my downtime, if I'm going to watch TV, it's either the news or HGTV, because I really like to watch interior design. And I enjoy decorating my house, and I've always, since I was young. Third thing, oh my goodness, this is tough. I've been on television a lot, so I feel like that's the third thing that most people probably do know about me, but is not technically on my CV, my work CV.
I love it. And going back to the interior design, people listening, we do this video so we can all see each other. I love that chair you're sitting in.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So it's seagrass. It. Yeah. My personal favorite is coastal farmhouse. Oh, now I'm going to have a dog barking.
Aww.
Sorry.
It's okay. We have a fourth guest.
I got too excited about the
chair.
I know. Yeah, about the decorating piece. Should have done that for my career.
Sounds great. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you a question about painting, Jen, which is, have you ever watched Bob Ross on his show? And do you ascribe to his philosophy of painting?
Fantastic question. I'm embarrassed to say I haven't been a big Bob Ross, watcher. I think it's fascinating how he does what he does, how he goes so quickly. My process is definitely not at all like Bob Ross. It's very slow, methodical, with lots of trial and error, because I really don't know what I'm doing. If that means anything, I really should take a paint class. I should have learned from Bob Ross, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Well, great. I wanted to follow up on, because I've been so curious for so long, with the question about your TV show. Because to some extent, I think we all kind of walk around feeling in some ways that there are eyes on us or the people are watching us, whether it's what we say or our performance or this or that. Give us a taste. What's it like of being on a TV show when there's cameras and all kinds of people? And is there a point that people just cross over and stop noticing that they're there? Or what's that like?
Yeah, it is definitely different. So it's interesting that you say, we're all aware at some level of people, watching us and when we're out and about. And I feel like from my perspective, because, I'm also a little person and, having a difference, a physical difference that is quite obvious, I feel like my whole life I've had this sort of exponentially heightened awareness of people watching me, staring, and all of that. So being on television, I don't know if that helped. I feel like it did. It made it easier because I'm sort of used to, I don't know what the word is, but feeling like, when you walk in a room, everyone's looking and wondering. And so that was a little bit easier, I think, for us, because I've always felt my entire life, like when I'm out in public, that I draw a lot of attention. The nice part about it was now people got to know me for who I am, as opposed to just someone who is a little person or, has a skeletal dysplasia without really understanding who I am as a person. So that was kind of nice. In fact, I think it made it a little easier to, in some respects, to go out in public because people already kind of know who you are and it's not a big deal. And that's why we did it, I guess, and in essence, hopefully making it better for all folks who have different disabilities. But being around the cameras, though, nonetheless, it is, when they're in your home and they're in your sort of your everyday life, there is a certain level of awareness that, I think I got pretty good at ignoring them because that's the whole point with, docudramas or reality TV, that you're supposed to ignore them. And so you do get to that point, but there's always a little sense of awareness that, hey, this could end up on camera. So you try not to do anything too dumb. You know what I mean? So there is, it's like, being at work, right? You don't do something too dumb because you don't want it to negatively impact what other people think of you. And so even though I'm good at ignoring the cameras and pretending like they're not there, I am aware of what I'm doing so that I don't do something too stupid. But I've done some stupid things on camera, like, especially when it comes to cooking, because that's not my forte. And so I've actually asked them, like, can you please edit that out? Because I'm totally embarrassed that people will now know that I don't know how to boil water, right? Something is stupid. Not that exactly, but pretty close. Like, I think I made my daughter tomato soup when she was sick on camera. And I didn't realize you had to add water. So I put the can in the thing. I heated it up. I gave it to her. And she's like, Mom, is this ketchup? Like, it was so thick. And of course, they caught it all on camera. And I was like, okay, fine, whatever. That's me. I did that for real.
Did it make it to TV?
Yes, it did. Of course. So, anyways, when reality cameras are around, they love that stuff. So if you don't want to look stupid on TV, don't do anything stupid is really the name of the game. Otherwise, it's going to be on TV.
I love it. And one more follow-up question about TV, which is, with all your experience, is television production in your future? And B, if you were going to do create a reality TV show of your own, what would it be?
Ah, great question. Yeah. So I am very open to future television. I think I found it as, a very empowering medium. However, I don't think it's going to be about my personal life anymore. I think I'm ready to be done with that. I think, we hope that the show that we had, had a positive impact. But I think at some point, no one else, we don't need that anymore. No one needs to see about like my everyday life. That's kind of boring, right? You already know it. Like, what else is there to say? How many times can someone watch you go into the grocery store, right? Exactly. So now it's time to move on. And so my goal actually is to marry both medicine and media. And I really am, actively sort of in the early stages of trying to create some type of medical media show.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredible.
So we'll see. We'll see. It may not come out to fruition, right? Because, the one thing I've learned with television is that, it ultimately comes down to networks and production companies' thoughts of what is interesting, what's going to be entertaining. And, it's hard to always make that work. Television is hard to make successful, surprisingly. So we'll see. We'll see what happens, but I'm trying.
Wow. I really look forward to the results of that.
Thank you.
So let us now rewind the clock and take a journey back in time go back to Kid Jen. Who is Kid Jen?
Ah, gosh, this is tough. Okay. Well, I would say as a kid growing up, I was generally speaking a pretty happy person. was kind of a tomboy for a long time. I like to build forts. I like to go outside. I still like going outside. I'm not very physically active, so I wasn't the kind of kid that did sports or anything. But probably the number one thing about Kid Jen is I was a social butterfly. So I like to spend time with friends, have parties, go to parties, do extracurricular activities. That was something that I think was definitely an important part of me. I guess the other thing about Kid Jen, I had a lot of surgeries growing up. So I had, maybe that's why I was a social butterfly, because I spent a lot of time, you know, recovering from orthopedic surgeries. So those times were pretty down times. You're kind of cooped up. You may be in a body cast. You're clearly not very comfortable after surgery. So I really embraced or valued, or I guess was excited about, when I was not having surgery, the ability to just really get out there and have fun. So, and I also worked really hard in school. I knew I had to, you know, work hard to get good grades. And so I was a little bit of a maniac. I think I pulled my first all-nighter. I don't know when you guys pulled your first all-nighter, but studying, I think my first all-nighter was in sixth grade. So.
Wow. Yeah. I think for me, it probably wasn't till high school, mid to late high school.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. So.
Do you remember what it was for?
Oh yeah, social studies, my least favorite subject, only because I am not good at it. Yep, social studies. Oh well, it is what it is.
It is what it is, yes. Well, let's talk a little bit about simulation. So can you tell us about your journey that got you into simulation?
Yeah. So for me, I think there were a couple of different forces, I guess, pushing me into that arena. One is when I was in fellowship, I knew that I wanted to contribute academically, and I knew that I wasn't really a bench researcher. I wasn't interested in the lab sort of environment. I tried it out in college and it was okay, but it just wasn't really my thing. And so I think from my perspective, that was one big reason why I latched on to education in general and then found simulation. Another factor was I think what pushed me into that field is that I learned pretty early on in my career, even as an intern in pediatrics, that I love teaching. I just really enjoyed that sort of work. And, you know, maybe in hindsight, I could have or should have been a teacher, but I felt that that was something that I enjoyed. And so when I heard about simulation from a colleague or, you know, a mentor at Pittsburgh, it made all the sense in the world. And then I think the other factor is that I also knew early on in my career that because of my physical disability, in order to stay in medicine in some way, in a contributing, impactful way, I knew I was going to have to find something other than clinical care that I liked and that I was good at and could allow me to be in medicine for a longer period of time. Because unfortunately, the osteoarthritis that I have starts when you're a teenager. And so, you know, at this point in my life, you know, I think I'm so thankful that I get around as well as I do. But, you know, I still have to have the occasional surgery, and I still have a lot of pain with long nights. So I do a lot less clinical care today because of that. It's just, I love neonatology. I miss it. Being in the unit for 36 hours at a time, you know, I enjoyed the adrenaline rush of caring for critically ill babies, but it's just physically exhausting. So I think I'm at the point now, I think early on in my career, I recognized that that was probably going to be a challenge. And so I knew I had to find something else that I enjoyed, that I felt was impactful, making a difference in patients' lives. And when I learned about simulation, it just felt so important and something that I could contribute to. And at the time at Pittsburgh, you know, when I first, learned about simulation from mentors at Weiser, I realized that not much was happening in neonatal care. As a fellow, I thought, well, I could be the first one to create a, you know, a simulation effort, an activity for our department. In fact, there was, you know, Mindy Fedor Hamilton was my main mentor in pediatrics, and she was doing it for pediatric critical care. So it was just sort of beginning, at least as far as my world I knew of in peds and neonatology. And so I grabbed on as hard as I could. I said, this is great. This is, you know, I can teach others. We can improve. It has impact on directly to patients. And it's not as physically demanding. So I found that as my niche.
Yeah.
To your observation around physical stamina and the system and the physical environment that we have today, and the assumption that in order to be a clinician, you have to have a certain level of physical capacity, stamina, and so forth. I have a friend who's a quadriplegic emergency room physician in Australia, and finding his way on creating inclusive environments for people with physical disabilities. What are your thoughts about what system improvements could create a more inclusive environment?
It's a really fantastic question. And wow, I would love to meet your friend, because I'm sure your friend has discovered so many things that could make our healthcare environment more inclusive for professionals. And, you know, I would say first and foremost is to be open-minded and to have frank conversations with individuals who have physical disabilities that want to, you know, be in medicine or in healthcare, and find out what their needs are, because I think the needs of each individual is going to vary. And so I think we have to keep our assumptions, throw assumptions and to the side, because when I was applying to medical school, that's exactly what I heard, you know, and it was written, I don't know if it still is today, but on the application, you know, we have the right to essentially deny admission to medical school if you don't have the physical and mental abilities to, you know, be a physician. While at some level I understand that, the problem was the assumptions, again, of what that needed to be able to practice medicine and contribute to healthcare. And, you know, I mean, I could tell you stories about my interviews. They were rather interesting. I came out of some interviews beet red. I didn't have many interviews to start off with to medical school because of that, I believe, to this now. Because I put in my essay, you know, I'm 3 foot tall. I wanted to go into medicine because I had benefited as a patient, and I wanted to contribute back, give back to healthcare. And I loved biology, loved science. So the combination just seemed right. Well, you know, when you think about the assumptions that happened, you know, people assumed that because I was only 3 foot tall that I couldn't care for patients. But the piece that they never did was ask me, you know, what were my thoughts? Or give me the chance to try and explore that, right? Obviously, as a college student, I may not have known everything that I would need to be successful. But it turns out that, you know, the things that I needed to be successful were relatively minimal. It was step stools, really, for me. But what's important is that every person's needs are going to be unique and different, but they are definitely more often than not doable, because no one goes into medicine wanting to, or you know, not wanting to make things better for patients. And no, I always said this when in some of my interviews, I would never go into medicine and want to put a patient's life at risk because I physically couldn't do something. But the problem was when I was applying to medical school, and I think even to this day, these stereotypes exist, is that people in medicine believe that you have to be a pluripotent stem cell, that you have to be capable of every aspect of medicine. And unless that's possible, then you're not contributing to medicine, but that is absolutely wrong. You know, yes, would it be physically hard for me to do CPR on a 6-foot person, or maybe, you know, do trauma surgery? Yes. Does it is it not possible? I don't know. If I had tried, it probably would have been possible. But I did find a field where my stature was not a limitation to be able to provide care. And it sometimes actually was helpful, with neonates. And then from there, obviously, I know my disability better than anyone else. And I think that's the other thing, is that we have to recognize that for folks with physical disabilities, that they know their limitations and their capabilities better than anyone. And you just have to have that conversation and not assume. And that's what's, I think, most important. I think the other piece, I'll tell you that we have a long way to go still, I think, in this arena, particularly with physical disabilities in our society and of course, in medicine. I even recently was told that I actually wanted to get back into the delivery room. And this is hard for me to even talk about, because I felt like, at this stage in the game, I've sort of proven myself, which it's sad that you have to prove yourself. But I wanted to start working in the delivery room. And there was an issue of obtaining step stools. And the issue that what ended up being conveyed to me was that this was not my organization that I was working at. It was an affiliate. So I'll just be clear about that. But the feedback that I got was that they weren't willing or able to purchase step stools to help me attend deliveries in this institution, in this hospital, because they had other neonatologists who could provide the same service. Wow, right? This is, not that long ago. And so when you think about that, I have to tell you, when I got that message, I didn't even know what to say, because I felt like we'd come so far. If that had happened to me 20 years ago, I probably would have said, oh, okay, I get it. Like, because we just weren't there. And, but today it still happens. So we have a long way to go, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And I think what needs to happen is we need to realize that we have to stop making assumptions. We have to be willing to put in what is often a little bit of effort to make it inclusive and equitable. And we have a long way to go. I don't know. I could unpack that some more, but I'll stop there for your thoughts.
I couldn't agree more. And for me, part of that story is to step away from the patronizing nature of tradition, that whoever that decision maker is knows best and is empowered to make decisions on behalf of, and what's best for another party, without, as you point out, ever asking or having curiosity about a possible solution.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the assumptions made. Wow. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, I think we have a long way to go still. I think we're making much more progress than we ever had. I mean, I can tell you, even just being a little person, I know so many more little people in medicine and healthcare today than when I was applying. I didn't know anyone. And that's why when people approached me in my interviews and said, how are you going to do this? How are you going to do that? I didn't know how to answer, because I was like, well, I don't know. I said, I think this, but I don't know anybody else that's done it. So... somebody,
so Jennifer,
gave me
a am I hearing a new reality TV show to help the community challenge these assumptions? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, yes, that would be fantastic in medicine.
Yes, exactly.
It could be
that.
Like a Henry Louis Gates Jr. show where he looks into people's ancestry, but instead of that, discover your assumptions.
Yes.
Yes, I love that.
Your assumptions.
Yep. Because we all have them. Yeah. Yeah. We all have them.
And we all think they're correct. Yeah.
I know. Just have to be curious. I love that, Christine, that you said that. Yeah. It's just all about being curious.
Yes. I love it.
I do think, I'm curious, I with your friend, you going, becoming an emergency medicine physician, I would love to hear him or her's perspective. I really would.
I will connect you. His name is Dinesh Palipana. And actually, he has a book that's going to be coming out sometime in this year. But I definitely will connect you.
Thank you. Because I think what people have to realize, again, also along the assumption side, is that medicine is not just about, your physical ability. It's you know, it's what's up here that's ultimately saves lives, and you don't have to do it all physically. So
it's and this podcast is about you, but I will share one interesting anecdote that after he had his spinal cord injury, he thought, well, I need to pivot, and thought that radiology could be a good specialty choice. And fascinatingly, radiology was a hard no, but it was the emergency room who said, you know what, let's find a way.
That's amazing. Yeah, more work to be done.
Okay, Jen, so thank you for sharing everything you have so far about your career. Now we're going to take a pivot. So if you had to do something completely different in your life professionally from anything that you currently do today, what would that thing be?
Ooh. Like just reinvent myself?
Absolutely, yes.
All right. Well, you know, what I would like to do, again, assuming that I could make it happen, I think I would like to be a news reporter. Isn't that weird? I think I would, like, I would, or, you know, a talk show host of some sort, but I'd want it to be helpful and informational. And I guess this is, you know, combining sort of my experiences thus far of in media, but I think there's just, you know, television is it's in some respects it's fun, I've learned that, but it's also something that is often, I think, what's the word? I think we squander opportunities to have a positive impact. Not everyone, but there's a lot of television out there that does this to do good as opposed to potential harm. And so I would love to either, you know, be a host for a show or to be a news reporter on a medium that is trustworthy and makes a difference and helps people to lead better and potentially healthier lives. Yeah, that's what I would do. I would probably do more television, but do it in a very non, reality world way. Something I haven't done yet.
I love it.
I love that.
Yeah. So Jen, one great thing about simulation is that we receive feedback and reflect on the choices that we make. So what is a choice that you encountered in your life that would have taken your life on a completely different path had you had made that choice?
Ooh, interesting question. So I almost became a marine biologist at one point in my life. That was a choice that I almost made to do. Mm-hmm. And then I pivoted when I realized that I really can't swim well, and so I'd be in the lab all the time. So that was more on me before I ever even applied to grad school. So I actually applied for and got accepted into a fellowship, a different fellowship than neonatology. And I almost went into being a pediatrician that specializes in caring for kids who are abused. So again, going back to children who suffer from non-accidental trauma. And that's a very hard specialty, I think, to be in. But I got accepted, I was supposed to go, and at the very last minute, probably not very well decision on my part, I should have made the decision sooner, I decided that I didn't want to go into that specialty because I think I feared that it would be hard, over time, the toll of dealing solely with that patient population would have been hard. I really admire those that do because it's so needed, unfortunately. But I almost went into that field, and then at the last minute, I pivoted and I decided to take some time. I worked as a hospitalist for about a year, and decided to go into neonatology instead. So. Almost was in a different field of pediatrics, but yeah.
Great. And related to that question then, what is a choice that you encountered in your life that felt risky at the time and that you're glad you made?
Marrying my husband? No, I'm kidding. Maybe. No, I guess, you know, no, I didn't feel that was too risky, I think, by that point in life. I would say that probably the riskiest decision that that I went forward with, and it was with my husband, was to say yes to the television show. And in hindsight now, I'm glad that I did. But, you know, when we were approached, let's see, if you want to hear the story of how we ended up with the television show, I was working at Stony Brook in Long Island. So it was my first year as an attending. And I took my first attending position as a neonatologist there because my husband was from there and we were getting married. And, you know, I was so excited. So I had a great opportunity there. And when I was there, Good Morning America did a special on women who had skeletal dysplasias and careers. And they had asked me if I'd like to be on that segment. And I said, sure, no problem. And then after it aired, we got approached by a production company to follow our wedding. And we actually said no. We said, you know, we thought about it and we said, no, you know, I really don't want to follow my wedding. I'm too excited about this. Too much pressure, you know, not much benefit, right? So we politely declined. And then they said, well, can we keep talking to you? And they kept talking to us for a year with a few other, you know, smaller ideas, pitches. They said they thought we had a good story and they wanted to follow us. Well, then at the final question that they pitched that we ended up after some deep thought, we agreed to, crazily enough, is to follow our lives with a actual pitch for a reality show. And I can tell you that I thought that they were crazy. And I thought, well, what are you going to do? Watch me going to work, watch my husband, you know, working, like that's all we do. We didn't have kids. We're, you know, newly married, but all we did really was work, work, work. But, you know, to be honest, the reason I said yes, and took that leap, for me, it wasn't for the pay, let me tell you, because they weren't paying much at all. I'd make more in a night on call in the NICU, which I had, you know, obviously spent most of my time doing, than I would, you know, creating an episode of television. But the reason we end up saying yes is probably about 6 months before they asked us this. The show The Little People Big World had aired, and I knew the couple that was on it, not well, but through the Little People of America community. And I had not actually even watched the show because I didn't have much time, but I'd heard about it and I thought, oh, isn't that great? You know, how weird, but okay, cool. And I was actually shopping and a little girl came up to me. I mean, this is so random, but at the time that we were trying to contemplate whether or not to say yes to the reality show. And she came up to me and she said, oh, it's nice to meet you. You're a little person like Little People, Big World. Well, you know, back then, the term little person was not widely known or accepted. And in fact, I mean, for a child especially who may not have had seemingly any experiences with little people, you know, most people would just have midget. And that's all I ever heard. And that's a very derogatory term. It's even hard for me to sometimes say. But midget is a very derogatory term because it's never been used in a positive way. You know, we call it the M word for many of us who are little people. Of course, some little people are actually okay with it, just, you know, but as a sign of empowerment. But in general, when folks who are not little people use the word, it's usually in a negative connotation. And so when I heard her use that word, little person, because she had learned it on that show, I thought, oh gosh, maybe we should say yes to this. Maybe we can have some positive impact too, you know. You know, how long can it last? One episode, right? Like, I think I thought, you know, we'll do what we can and it will get canceled after the pilot and that'll be that. So honestly, we took that leap and I can tell you to this day, I can't believe we were on television for as long as we were and for 14 seasons. We never expected it to go this far, but I'm glad that we did. And I think we've had a lot of great experiences from it and hopefully had some positive impact from it.
I think you've had a lot of positive impact. So yeah. Congratulations. Thanks. On taking that risk. We're grateful you did. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's go in a little different direction if you're game.
Sure.
So we have a game that we play on this podcast, and it's basically, we're going to put 60 seconds on the clock And we're going to ask you just some random questions, and you just answer with the first thing that comes to mind. How about that?
Ooh, okay. So this is like a time-sensitive thing.
Well, see, the 60 seconds is more of a soft goal.
It always is.
I'm not sure how often we...
I don't think we've ever kept to it.
But, excellent. Sorry. Sounds good.
The behind the scenes of BS.
There you go. There you go. I talk a lot too. So,
we have 60 seconds on the clock. And Christine, you can start with the first question. Here we go.
Great. What is one thing that you own that you should really throw out?
Okay. I have literally a whole pile of scrubs from med school.
Okay.
I just can't part with them.
Okay. So what's your go-to guilty pleasure?
Oh, popcorn and wine.
Together at the same time?
Uh-huh. Yep.
What is the scariest animal?
The scariest animal to me is probably an alligator.
Hmm. Good reason. Yeah. You only get to listen to one song for the rest of your life. What is it?
These Are the Days by Natalie Merchant.
Love it. Okay. Cool. And last question.
Last question. What is the last thing that you read other than email?
The last thing that I've read? Like?
Literally.
Literally. Text message? something more serious than that? Oh, gosh. Like a book?
Text message it is.
Text message it is. I feel like I don't read enough books, but I'm getting ready to go on vacation. I'm going to read a book for fun.
Good.
Awesome. All right. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. All right. So we're coming around the corner to finish. And with that, I would like to ask you to think about one person who was meaningful to you in your life. And it doesn't have to be somebody that you necessarily knew. And what did you learn from them, or what do you admire about them?
You know, this is a hard question, probably one of the hardest, because I think there's lots of different people that I've admired in my life, both that I've known and that I haven't, for many different reasons, right? We learn so much from everyone. I would say, can I pick two? I'll just keep it short.
Of course, of course.
I would say one is my surgeon growing up. He was just quite a remarkable human being. And what I admired about him was that he saw a need in a population of patients that no one else was caring for and decided to dedicate his entire practice to it, knowing that it probably did not pan out financially or, you know, even, you know, reputation-wise. I mean, he had a great reputation, but, you know, in terms of being in a high-powered academic institution, like doing what he did, I think ended up causing him to leave. So like probably didn't have necessarily a positive impact in his career from that perspective. But he did amazing work and he's the reason I'm here today. So that would be one person. I admire someone that's willing to take that risk to do what they see is a need, to fill a need that's critical, even for a small population, no pun intended. Second, I would say today is my aunt's birthday, and my aunt unfortunately passed away from suicide, and she was someone was my best friend growing up, and so I learned a lot from her, and I think the thing that I learned the most is that you really got to make time for the people and the things in life that make you happy. And she and I used to spend a lot of fun time together doing the things that we liked, even the simple things. And so that's the other person I admire, is how she lived life to the fullest when she was with us.
Thank you so much for that.
Yes, thank you.
And I love that even though she's no longer with us, that you still celebrate her and the times that you shared together.
Thank you. Yeah.
Great.
Means a lot.
Jen, one last question. What is one hope you have for simulation in the future?
That's a fantastic question, and I'm probably not alone in this, but my hope is that simulation, twofold. One is that it is readily available and integrated into the framework of everything we do in healthcare. And I know that's a sort of a big hope. What does that really mean? I mean, I think it's that institutions have the ability to invest, or they're supported, whether that's through, federal funding, or you just, it's a line item on the budget, but that simulation really does spread within organizations so that it's used as a true safety tool and a training tool. And then I think second to that is that we really do see a change in how we provide, again, it goes back to my interest in patients and families, but that we see simulation as part of our sort of required toolbox for training patients and home caregivers and how to take better care at home. I've been a patient all my life and now, a clinician and also an educator. And I think we're really missing an opportunity to use simulation directly for patients and families. You know, it's hard to be patient nowadays. You go home having to do so many things that are scary, and it's your own health or it's the health of someone you care about as patients have more complexity at home. And so I think that's a great tool that I think everyone should have access to, because I believe it saves lives.
Thank you so much for sharing that vision and that hope. And we're totally with you on that.
I knew. I thought you would be.
So Dr. Jennifer Arnold, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast today. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. This has been BS, Beyond Simulation. Thank you for listening, and join us for a future episode.
This is Christine Park and Bob Kaiser signing off.